Welcome back to Wellness Weekly. I'm your co-host, Nora.
And I'm your co-host, Isabel. In Wellness Weekly, we like to be real and dive deep into topics that we want to make mainstream when it comes to wellness and health.
We want this podcast to be a safe space for everybody, and we're so happy you're here. It's your co-host, Nora. Me and Isabel are so excited to be back on schedule to give you guys weekly episodes this quarter. We have a lot planned and we're really looking forward to sharing what we've got with you guys. And we really appreciate your listenership. This quarter, I'm going to be primarily hosting Wellness Weekly and Isabel will join me in hosting every other week. But not to worry, we're going to make all the episodes worth your while. Quick shout out to our sponsor for this episode, Elm Coffee Roasters. Elm Coffee Roasters is open in Pioneer Square and South Lake Union for takeout and soon indoor seating. Order coffee and more at elmcoffeeroasters.com. In this episode, we have an absolutely phenomenal guest that we were so pumped to be able to invite over. We will be extending the conversations that we've covered in earlier episodes of Wellness Weekly, like productivity and mental health episode and capitalism is bad for your mental health episode. So I encourage you guys to check those out. I'll let today's guest introduce themselves.
Hi, everyone. My name is Melody Lee. I use pronouns ko in Cantonese and any in English. And I am located on the land of the Jumano Nation, Tonkawa Tribe, and the Kowawitika Nation, also known as so-called Austin, Texas, by its colonial name. And I am a colony-born migrant, a settler on Turtle Island, and also a therapist of color, and just person that loves life, loves people, loves animals and nature. And in addition to that, I'm the founder of Inclusive Therapists, which is a mental health directory and community that celebrates the strengths of and also centers the needs of people with marginalized identities, particularly the QT BIPOC intersection.
That's absolutely phenomenal. Like, we're totally in love with Inclusive Therapists. Like, I think we were talking about before, and we think that it's such a revolutionary idea that, you know, it's giving people that kind of like the resource to realize that there are people out there that will be able to give you the support that you need. Because one of the issues that we've touched on in Wellness Weekly a lot is how therapy is kind of a system that has been built for a very small and narrow group of people. And it's like, it's a very, like, it was built to kind of provide help for cishet people, and particularly cishet white men. And it's, that is kind of upheld by capitalism and a lot of systems that just enforce that. And we're just really happy to hear that people are acknowledging that, you know, mental health support that is centered around narrow identities is, it's alienating to other people, and we need to have more inclusive therapy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm so glad that you touched on what the current mental health system looks like, you know, AKA the mental health industrial complex, that it is unfortunately capitalistic and also, as you say, narrow. And beyond the fact that the mental health field is only designed to serve, you know, a small homogeneous population. But when we look back at the origins, that how health and wellness is defined, so much of that was through the powers that cishet white men had in defining what is considered mental wellness, what is considered health. And anyone that doesn't fit into those bubbles or those definitions then are othered, stigmatized, punished, institutionalized. And these practices are also perpetuated through the mental health field currently, through pathologizing cultural practices, through capitalizing upon and co-opting upon indigenous and ancestral healing practices of indigenous and, you know, communities of color. And there's so many forms of exploitation and violation and harm that has been done through the mental health field. And I think we're in a time of reckoning to look at not only the history, but also at how the system continues to perpetuate harm when it is marketed to heal.
Yeah, those are such important points. And I think, like, one of my friends was talking about how for a while she was considering becoming a therapist, but then she noted how, at least like in her education, it mostly felt as though what she would be doing is pathologizing what they said logical reactions to oppressive systems. And I thought that that was a very, very powerful quote, like, and just goes to show how pervasive those systems of oppressions are within mental health. So I was wondering if you could speak to your process for how you built your practice and what motivated you to build it, kind of like the steps involved.
When I think about my practice, I have to go back to my people's story. That's where it originates. It doesn't start with me. It starts with my lineage and my ancestors being born in colonial Hong Kong, which was a British colony until 1997. My family, my lineage experienced direct colonial harm and trauma, which showed up in the forms of self-harm, alcoholism, suicide, fractures in relationships, disconnection to land and spirituality, and internalizing things such as capitalism and internalize white supremacy myth, also, you know, homophobia, transphobia. All these things were indoctrinated into myself, my parents, many of my family members. And so I didn't have language for that growing up. It was just happening around me, happening to me. In order to survive, we have to buy into it and we have to follow through. We didn't have the power to say no. People in positions of power did not look like us, did not sound like us, and we didn't have a lot of options. And I think growing up in colonial Hong Kong, and then my family, my immediate family, had the privilege to migrate to so-called Canada, which is a land that has, like, I don't even have the words for it, been, you know, people of the land experienced genocide, displacement, enslavement. All of these trauma doesn't even start to talk about the horrors. And landing in that place as a migrant and starting to realize that what is showing up symptomatically in people that have been oppressed is directly connected to our historical and intergenerational experiences of trauma. And at the same time, recognizing that our peoples have always known how to heal. We've always known how to take care of one another, right? This is how we survived, even through attempted erasure of our healing practices. So I had these concepts embodied that I didn't have language for. But over time, as I started to read and learn, and especially learning and reading from writers that are abolitionists, that are activists, then I started to be able to put name to not only my experience, but seeing that in connection with communities, especially communities of color around me. That really is the foundation of my work. And so I did the thing. I got my master's. I went through the colonial institution. I got my license. I jumped through the hoops. I had a lot of privilege that I had my family support. I had, you know, I had literacy privilege, neurotypical privilege. And there were times when I was going through school and through these trainings, and I thought, this doesn't sit well in my stomach. This isn't right. And at the same time, knowing that there, even if I spoke up, I would be silenced, that the, some professor or student was just going to throw some empirical studies my way and go, tell me why I'm wrong, right? Delegitimize my lived experiences and what I learned in relationships with other people that have experienced depression. And so after I graduated from school and went through my internship, I'm very fortunate that I have a supervisor that is a woman of color that saw something in me, saw the fire in me, and was just very supportive, Nadia, and saying, you have to do it your way. That there is no mental health space or agency or group practice that I could fit into. And she was so supportive of me just taking a risk and finding other like-minded people to start my practice with. And that is how Austin Counseling Collective came to be. Started out as a teeny tiny group practice with very clear values that we centered on people with marginalized identities, that we are boldly social justice and liberation oriented. And from there, we attracted other practitioners and providers that share in that spirit. And we all bring different gifts. We also bring different lived experiences and traumas too. So we can co-support one another, heal with one another, but also inform one another. And at times challenge one another, right? Nudge and push one another to grow. And that is a community that is very dear to me. And it came to be because it's something that I needed, but also knew that the community in Austin also needed.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. And yeah, we are so, so glad that you took that step and created that practice. I'm curious about what are some of the highlights and some of the challenges of your job, just like in a typical week or anything in particular that comes to mind?
Highlights and challenges. The highlight is I get to meet amazing people, like right now, just being able to connect with folks that I think my spirit really needs to know that there are others out there like me that are, you know, centered on liberation, and being able to expand my heart and mind constantly. That is my favorite part. Some of the challenges would be, it's sometimes difficult for me to find balance between work and also tending to my own care. And I know this is common for a lot of providers, but also for students, for people in helping or caring professions. And I'm certainly not exempt. I care deeply about my work. And so I need to be mindful to also have space for play, to be silly, to be mindless sometimes. And so that is part of the challenge. I think another aspect of it is that, you know, what social justice and liberation oriented providers bump up against is a lot of pushback. Because we are still a minority. We are maybe perceived as radical, even though I don't think we're radical. I just think that we're rehumanizing. We are restoring and reclaiming. But the majority of our field either doesn't understand why dismantling systems of oppression and advocating for land back and Indigenous sovereignty, Black liberation, liberations of all beings is important and how that's connected to mental well-being, either that they don't get it or we're not believed, or that the field is so stubborn or so afraid to look in the mirror, that I do get a lot of pushback. And knowing how to, when to lean into dialogue that could be generative and when to pull away and say, you know what, not today. Those are some everyday challenges that I experience.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I would imagine that evaluative sort of pr- process that happens very regularly for you on like what is worth your energy and what's not worth your energy. And I can't imagine like how tiring it is for you to be, you know, kind of like you said, being pushed. There's like a lot of pushback, even though I would imagine there is not much harm for these people if the goals that you're trying to achieve are achieved. Like nothing that you're saying is personally threatening to, you know, to the people that are doing the pushback, which is all of more the reason for me to be a little bit like, why are you doing this? You know, like just look in the mirror, like you said, just be honest. And, you know, you mentioned rehumanizing and reclaiming a lot of and like incorporating these into mental health. And I remember reading in your website that you had this quote that you lead mental health liberation movement to decolonize, disrupt, and dismantle oppressive mental health practices. And in the community, we restore, reimage, and reclaim our healing. And I just love that so much. I wanted to expand more on what oppressive mental health practices can look like, because I think a lot of people don't understand what they even can look like, especially for like a client who has a relationship with a therapist. And I think it would be helpful for our listeners to kind of understand if they're in a position where oppressive mental health practices are being used, you know, how they can recognize their position and sort of be aware of it and put kind of like get themselves out of that situation, basically.
No, I love that question. And as I'm hearing you question, why is there so much pushback against mental health liberation? One reason is because mental health professionals hold a lot of power. And so for folks that may have been indoctrinated into or have inherited colonial mindsets and ways of being, power hoarding is one of the outcomes. And we are in a field that protects people that hold a lot of power and also esteems and positions us to believe that we're entitled to hold this much power. And so that really firstly creates a hierarchy within the therapeutic relationship. There's this assumption that therapists have it all together. They know a lot of things. They know what's best for service users. And also that our field is somehow noble and are on top of regulations to ensure best practices. When in reality, any organization or institution that holds that much power and teaches and trains their members to hoard power, we are so prone to exploit our power. And how that can show up in the therapeutic relationship is, ooh, let me tell you, there's so many ways. I mean, starting with, let's talk about forms, informed consent. What does informed consent mean? And typically it would be a document that a person that may not understand the, you know, therapy jargon, they may not understand the process, they're supposed to read through. And if they don't understand, then they may feel guilty, like, oh, I'm not sure exactly what this is talking about, but I assume that the therapist knows what they're doing, right? So even in the informed consent process, which really is part of the beginning of the therapeutic relationship, that already sets things up where the therapist knows a lot and assumes that the service user will just follow along. And when in reality, you know, the service user is the expert of their lived experience and is also the expert of their culture and what they are needing. And so there often isn't space for dialogue about how therapy works, how therapy is structured. Therapists might say, you know, the way that I work is you got to come in every week and I dictate the schedule, I dictate the fees. And so there's a lot of therapist-driven decisions that are made without really true consent from service users. So that is just one example. And so when people are seeking a therapist, I think one thing that they can look for is how open is the therapist to having open, transparent dialogue about what the therapeutic process is actually going to look like. Are they willing to demystify the process? One way we hold power is to make this a mysterious process, right? If you don't know what's going on, then I hold all the power. But can they truly convey and give answers so that the service user can go, yeah, I know exactly what's going to happen. I feel empowered to ask questions. I feel empowered to push back. I know that I can leave at any time. I know that any contracts or forms that I sign, they're not concrete. We can scrap them and change them at any time, that I can voice up, you know? And so putting the power back in service users into their hands, I think is one way to that we can power share in the therapeutic relationship. And so these are some kind of early signs to look for. Another way that we power hoard is there's this falsehood that therapists are supposedly, this is not true, it's a myth, supposedly unbiased, that we are non-judgmental, or maybe we're even blank slates. And our job is to, in an unbiased, compassionate, empathetic fashion, hold up a mirror to reflect back what service users are offering to us. That is a myth, and I can even call a dang lie, that I was taught that in order to be, you know, a master therapist, and this is language that's in these trainings that we go to, I don't make this up, that how do we strive to be unbiased and non-judgmental? This is actually a really dangerous myth, because first of all, it conveys that I, as a therapist, do not need to reveal anything about myself, that my story, my being, my identity is neutral and doesn't show up in a therapeutic space, which is impossible. And secondly, why that's dangerous is then when service users open up and share their vulnerable parts, share their stories, then they're revealing such important, precious, valuable things about them. And I, as a therapist, don't have to. Wow, what a way to hoard more power, right? Now, I'm holding these stories and I get to interpret them. I get to help make meaning of them. And so mutuality and transparency are two things that can help with dismantling these really nuanced, sometimes less nuanced ways that we're taught to uphold power. So say, I'm human too. These are the ways that I'm human. I'm going to be transparent with you about what my values are, what my biases are, what has informed my practice. And the mutuality is you're welcome to ask me questions. So one red flag is if a person is interviewing with a therapist, which I often recommend for people to do, and the therapist is unwilling are hesitant about offering answers or to share about themselves, then I'll go, what's that about? And how is that going to impact the mutuality in the therapeutic relationship moving forward? So those are some initial ways that we are trained to uphold these values without even questioning. I just remember I never even questioned. It's like, this is the way we do things. That can perpetuate harm, but there are many more.
Before we continue with our interview, I'm going to give another quick shout out to our sponsors for this episode, Elm Coffee Roasters. Open since 2015, Elm Coffee Roasters is devoted to high quality coffee that's easy to brew at home and a joy to drink. At our roastery and cafe in Pioneer Square, Seattle, Elm obsessively roasts small batches of coffee that they source with a focus on sustainable practices that lift up the whole supply chain and protect the future of the coffee plant. Elm's goal is to make a truly exceptional cup of coffee and an experience that you look forward to every day. Cafes in Pioneer Square and South Lake Union open now for takeout and soon indoor seating. Please use code podcast at elmcoffeeroasters.com for 15% off your next coffee order. Now back to the interview.
Thank you so much for that answer. And I think like those are all like such powerful points. Something when I was looking at your website, I saw is that you are especially looking to help people who have been re-traumatized by the therapy process and by therapists who fail to address their own positionality in the therapeutic relationship. So I'm curious as to what are some of the steps you take to help clients feel safe in a therapeutic space after they have had very negative experiences with power hoarding and with therapists who are culturally incompetent?
I start from a place of resonance, shared experience. I have been gaslighted in therapeutic relationships. I have felt that parts of my identity were looked over, neglected, not validated. And so in my body, I have a felt sense of what that's like. I don't get to define what safety feels like or looks like in a space. Rather, when we meet, one thing I think is really important is to hold space for stories to be told, for the nuances and the complexities to be seen and to be validated. And returning to storytelling and moving away from pathologizing. And so when I begin to do that, and also just show up as the imperfect human that I am, then the service user and I will then begin to negotiate what safety looks like in a therapeutic relationship. And there is no one way that that looks. For some service users, they will say, I want you to be firm and to call me out on my BS. That is how a person will feel safe, that they, how do we establish trust? And another service user might say, actually, I am just needing an empathetic ear. And that process evolves over time. They might be asking for different things at different time. Can you follow me? Am I too much? You know, can all of me show up? And so being able to validate those experiences could be another way to co-build safety in the therapeutic relationship. But that looks so different. And so I think constructing that, co-creating that, takes dialogue, takes willingness to take risks, knowing that there are times when rupture might happen. Sometimes I might think this is, you know, the best path or option. I might be wrong. And am I willing to take accountability, to seek repair? I think these are all ways that I attempt to build safety in therapeutic relationship, especially the part of being willing to seek repair when I make mistakes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that answer. And I think for me, like myself, I have never had a therapist like personally apologize to me, but I imagine it would be an extremely powerful process to be able to, like, in a therapeutic setting, have like that accountability and have that ability to, like, you know, practice that rupture and repair in a space that feels very safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I might add to that, like, everything that you just said was kind of super enlightening to me as someone who's been traumatized by like therapist relationships before, because I've had like therapists to be like, I would tell them, here's where you like offended me, or here's where you, you know, did something that was hurtful to me. And the response that I would get would be like aggression and kind of like, no, you misunderstood what I was trying to say, you, and gaslighting, basically, like you said. And that is super, it puts you back to ever think like, okay, do I have the power to go through therapy again and try and find someone who's actually going to listen and not power hoard? So hearing you say that is like, I think to me, and I imagine to a lot of other people who are listening, is super validating that, you know, it's not you, it's the system. Like, you know, it is possible that your therapist has said something that offended you, and they just, you know, it's just, it's just reaffirming, I think, to hear that. So I really appreciate that. So kind of tying back to the relationship between capitalism and mental health, we tried to talk about like radical self-care and radical community care. And we want to kind of hear from you how you define those two things and what are, this is like a compounded question, but what are like the steps to incorporate this kind of care into your life as a like form of resistance to capitalism?
Ooh, powerful question. Radical self-care and radical collective care to me are interconnected, that they coexist, that they need each other, that we need each other. This is a big question. I need to sit, pause, and think about this. For people that have experienced colonization and systemic and structural oppression, so many ways that we historically, ancestrally have tended to ourselves and one another have been attempted to be shunned, delegitimized, called things like superstitious, unscientific, or even attempted to be erased. And so when I hear radical, I think I see two aspects. One is reclamation. It's reconnecting, rerooting back with our ways of being before we were told that there's something wrong with us, before we were pathologized, so that the system can sell us more things, like sell us cures, sell us treatments and so forth. So there's that rerooting and reclamation aspect. And the other part is also re-envisioning and reimagining new and different ways of being. And this is something that, yes, one can integrate into practices through, you know, learning about one's lineage, about researching, about finding one's joy, healing, wellness through arts, through dance, through food, through medicines, through nature. There are all these ways that we can tend to ourselves. At the same time, I think it's necessary for us to come together as a community to recognize that these traumas and also this displacement is something that happened to us collectively. And that we are more resilient together, we're more resourced together, our combined imaginations and creativity shine brighter together, and that there is something healing and restorative about sharing space, sharing story, sharing food, sharing laughter, grieving with, that requires collective care as well. And so I am absolutely an advocate for self-care that has to be non-exploitive. That means through our self-care practices that we're not exploiting people, land, animals, nature, that is anti-oppressive and anti-violent. And so if my self-care practices hurts me or people around me, then, you know, can I call that self-care? And also that I think the richness and the deepness comes when we learn to tend to and lean on one another, creating mutuality and interconnection. And also there is celebration and rituals that can only happen in community. Those are some ideas that I have. Love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the times when one considers therapy, it's a very individualized process, like just kind of you and the therapist, and then like you doing all that inner work. But like true, like deep healing doesn't happen in a vacuum. I think it can only happen like in a relational context. And I think, I mean, of course, it's so important to be able to like take the time and space for yourself, but especially in like individualized, like white United States culture, like in my own experience, we're taught to think of healing as something, it's just like you and maybe a therapist, or you and a bunch of like self-help books, rather than like you and your community, which is ultimately when we can make that substantial progress too, in terms of dismantling like the oppressive systems that are fueling very negative mental health effects.
I'm snapping my fingers. Yes to all of that.
Yeah. So then a final question kind of relating to your previous response is, how do you balance helping clients empower themselves in the faces of like very, very violent, very, very oppressive systems? How do you find that balance between validation of pain and validation of trauma, or things like beyond trauma caused by these systems, with helping clients feel as though they can feel better, or helping them find strategies that work for them for their own mental health?
To add on to that really quickly, how do you make kind of the distinction between, you know, your clients, for your clients, between them taking care of or taking the responsibility for improving their mental health, while also acknowledging that a lot of their mental health issues are inherently upheld by the system that we have, including the therapeutic relationship?
I love these questions. When I think about collective trauma, for example, racialized trauma, I know that trauma in itself is painful. It is heavy. It can be just challenging. But I know what adds an added layer of pain is feeling alone. And like, I'm the only one that is experiencing this, seeing this. And so in the therapeutic space, firstly, I wish to undo the aloneness, to know that I am in this with you, that I may not necessarily be able to make things better. However, can we look at this together? Can I validate that your experiences are not only real, but that there are clues in there that point us towards what you're needing? And can I be a support system for you to pursue, to advocate on your behalf, to feel empowered to go for what you are needing? The way that I work is that I am their advocate inside the therapeutic space. And also I'm very clear that I am an advocate for you outside of the therapeutic setting. That while it may feel like sometimes when we're together that this is a space that you can share experiences, we can look at ways to cope, we can look at resources together, we can try new and different things, but that I'm also doing the work outside the therapeutic space to push for these systemic changes. And oftentimes service users also join me in that. They'll say, I want to make these systemic changes as well. And for folks that I work with, a lot of times there isn't that initial connection between their so-called symptoms, right? Their challenges, mental distresses, and what is happening systemically. And so firstly, naming that, putting language to that is empowering. But that also means that they can take that back into their families, into their communities, to start to have these conversations as well. And so as they are empowered, they also empower their people. As they experience healing, they can also extend healing to their people. And so I see that our therapeutic space, even if it's one-on-one, it is only a catalyst for collective healing as well. And then comes inspiration that as service users feel empowered, as they experience healing, then oftentimes they want to also pursue, you know, the decolonial and liberatory work. And having a therapist that is also on that journey, that says, I'm right alongside you, we're doing this together, and I know that it's important for you to find your people to do this alongside too, that I am certainly not your only support system. Let me help find ways to help get you plugged in. You know, this is the way that I can just be one part of their healing journey. And yeah, I think that's all I want to say. And to be okay with that, to say that I am just one part of that and feel good about that.
Well, thank you so, so much for all your time and your amazing responses and just for sharing this space with us.
Yeah, we're really, really honored that, you know, you took the time and we're so excited to release this episode because we think it ties together so many of the topics that we talked about in mental health, and it kind of like, it's like a common thread that, you know, we're able to like put it all and speak to you about some of the issues. And we're just so happy that you took the time to talk to us.
It has been such a pleasure and joy to share space with you, Nora and Isabel. And I am just deeply honored to be invited. And I hope that this can also be a catalyst for folks to bring these conversations into their communities as well.
We're so excited to see more of your work. We're like going to be loyal supporters of all the movements and the organizations that you establish. And we're just so proud of you. Like genuinely, I think mm-hmm. we just have to say this. You could have just taken the easy route and just been complicit, you know, but you chose the hard one and you're advocating for the voices of people who, you know, don't have the means to advocate for themselves.
Thank you so much. I received that, and that propels me to continue this work.
Thank you for tuning in.
We are really looking forward to having you back on our next episode, and we hope that this week you find a way to take care of yourselves, whatever that looks like for you. Bye, everyone.